From the newsroom of Impact Alpha, I'm Brian Walsh, and this is your Impact Briefing for Friday, June 9th. Today, I'm joined by Impact Alpha contributing editor Imogen Rose Smith to discuss her latest institutional impact column, where she counters that despite the recent ESG backlash, institutional investors are plowing into climate investing. Hi, Imogen, and welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Brian. It's good to be here.
So we don't have our full roundtable contingency this week, as David Bank is off.
But we will soldier on without him. I feel confident in us.
I believe in us as well. But first, here's what you need to know from This Week in Impact Investing. In the municipal bond market, racial equity audits of underwriters are becoming a tool to mitigate risk. In the aftermath of George Floyd's murder in 2020, a simple tool to identify and weed out discriminatory practices at corporations became a favorite of shareholders looking to mitigate racial equity risk in their portfolios. Now, investors are looking to deploy racial equity audits in the $4 trillion municipal bond market, or muni market, which is burdened by systemic inequities. One shareholder proposal requesting an audit of Goldman Sachs highlights proceeds of Chicago-issued municipal bonds. The bonds, which were underwritten by Goldman, have been used to pay hundreds of millions of dollars in police brutality settlements. Still, the current racial equity audit doesn't have specific instructions for assessing risk in fixed income portfolios. That's according to David Wood of Harvard's Initiative for Responsible Investment, which has been working with institutional asset allocators to explore racial equity strategies across asset classes, including muni bonds. To hear from David Wood and other special guests, join our next Agents of Impact call number 51. There's an RSVP link in this week's episode show notes. In the June list of impact funds currently raising, managers are getting creative with catalytic capital for energy, nature, and financial inclusion. Energy Peace Partners and impact fund manager Cameo are out to prove that even in conflict zones, there are investable opportunities in basic services. They can't test their hunch with commercial capital. Such financing doesn't exist for the renewable energy projects the partners are supporting in Sudan, Somalia, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. An energy credit mechanism the pair developed will allow project developers to get funding upfront for energy they produce in the future. Lendable is in the market with its second fund to invest in emerging market fintech ventures that are driving financial inclusion. The fund has four tranches to encourage a mix of investors to back its approach, which will use impact incentives to get fintechs to strengthen their commitments to women. Check out the rest of the list on impactalpha.com. And finally, Common Futures' Rodney Foxworth, who oversaw the Oakland-based nonprofit's evolution from grantee to impact investor, is moving on. Foxworth and Common Future colleague Caitlin Morelli are launching Worth More, an impact investing and venture development firm that will advise investors and help founders develop business models that deliver long-term impact for stakeholders. And now it's time for our Hamstrung Roundtable. Imogen, as our resident lovable curmudgeon, you usually bring a healthy dose of skepticism when it comes to institutional investors getting into impact. David is usually our starry-eyed idealist, but your latest institutional impact column is quite optimistic. Why the change of heart?
Well, maybe in part, I'm trying to make up for David's absence by bringing, you know, sprinkling some fairy dust of optimism to the conversation. But that's not really it. If anything, you know, this column sort of really grew out of a sense of frustration with this sort of like, ooh, ESG, yes or no, back and forth debate that we're seeing, you know, sort of an endless loop in particular in the US. And what I had been noticing is that, you know, in reality, if you sort of just look under the hood and look at dollar flow and workflows and where investments are going, there's actually an awful lot of very interesting stuff happening in the climate investment space across the ecosystem, from a lot of infrastructure investments and venture capital commitments, you know, private equity, public markets. The clean energy transition train in many respects has left the station. We're long past the point where people are like, oh, you know, solar, can you make money from this or not? And that's the level of the debate. What you're seeing amongst sort of sophisticated institutional investors is that there's a lot of activity and there's a lot of opportunity, and that people are responding to that. And if you compare this to, say, where we were even 5 years ago, it's really night and day.
Now, not all institutional investors are born the same, and not all of them have the same kind of outlook on this matter. So where are you seeing the concentration of institutional investors who are leaning into these opportunities for renewable and the clean energy transition?
So certainly you're seeing a lot of it amongst, you know, what we would consider to be the usual suspects, right? In particular, the large Canadian pension plans. Norway just made a big offshore wind investment. So effectively, large institutional asset owners who have gotten the memo on climate change. That said, it's not necessarily that this is being driven by, you know, a desire to sort of tick the box on ESG per se. You tend to find that stuff like the Canadians they tend to do a lot of infrastructure investment anyway. So this sort of naturally fits within their wheelhouse. What they're now seeing is genuine investment opportunities at scale that fit what they're good at, i.e. infrastructure, and also have this climate component to them. But the point in part is it's not necessarily just the usual suspects. You're also seeing really interesting things like, you know, the Wall Street Journal of all things had a great article the other day on this former paper company in, I think it was Alaska, that's now like one of the major providers of lithium. So this is a publicly traded company that is financially benefiting from the supply chain that we need to create batteries for the clean energy transition. So, you know, plenty of institutional investors are invested in that without even necessarily knowing that they are, because it's in the public markets, right? And so the point is, like, you're seeing these kind of opportunities throughout the kind of investment ecosystem.
Now, are these investors, though, making these investments because of climate change and what they believe as a need to green the economy, if you will? Or are they making these investments because they see them as smart fiduciary choices to make for their long-term investment horizons?
I mean, the answer is really all of the above. I think what has changed and what is important to understand here is the sort of the geopolitical landscape, right? And in particular, what we've seen happen, you know, basically since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, is policy changes that are incentivizing greater investment in the clean energy transition. So in the US in particular, you know, the Biden administration has done a series of things to encourage, the Biden administration has done a series of things that are encouraging investment. The EU has done the same. There are policy changes in the UK and Germany as well. So that in some ways was the starting gun that a lot of investors were waiting for, because it de-risks some of these investments, and the government is effectively putting up money, which encourages these institutions to follow suit.
And you noted at the top of your column that the irony of that Politico last year named Russian President Vladimir Putin as the number one on their list of the most influential power players driving Europe's green agenda. So how much is the geopolitics of the war in Ukraine driving all of this?
It's a huge driver. You know, I think part of it is the policy implications that I just mentioned. It's also the impact that had on energy prices and also commodity prices, which again is also sort of a positive and a negative, right? So the rise in commodity prices has an impact on how effective these investments can be, especially when you're using commodities to build batteries and stuff. But, you know, the other thing was is Putin's invasion of Ukraine sort of exposed just how dependent Europe was on Russian oil and gas. And, you know, for all Germany sort of banging on about being clean, they had to recognize we're really not. And so there is a whole sort of, again, geopolitical game going on here. So last summer, you saw a bunch of the Canadian pension plans, you know, rushing off to Germany to go and talk to German officials and talk about how they were going to invest in German infrastructure. Like, that's not a coincidence. That was not happening in a vacuum. That is sending a clear signal about where Canada wants the world to go. These things are not neutral. You know, the flip side of that is, again, the anti-ESG backlash that we're seeing in the US is about, you know, Texas and Utah and West Virginia really trying to defend their oil and gas economies. In some ways, you know, it's just the opposite side of the same coin.
You're not claiming that fossil fuel investments, oil and gas, and yes, even coal, are being removed from all institutional investors' asset mix, right? It's still a part of many investors' portfolios. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely not. I, if anything, I think we are likely to see more oil and gas investment among some institutions, particularly in the U.S., because, again, the other part of the geopolitical discussion is a push for energy independence. And so that means more investing in, you know, like Texas oil fields, more investing in, you know, pipelines. And again, we've seen legislation passed that's going to encourage that. It's sort of like combo of we're going to do climate stuff and we're going to do pipelines. And again, that's you know, I think it's naive to assume that, oh, you know, long-term allocators, you know, have a fiduciary duty to invest in renewables and they should stop investing in fossil fuels. Because, you know, the duration of most private equity funds is like 10 years effectively, plus maybe a couple more. It's perfectly possible to still make money in oil and gas in that time horizon. So you know, don't mistake the idea that these institutions have an infinite time horizon with what they are actually doing in terms of their investment activity. So no, I think you will continue to see investments in fossil fuels. I mean, coal is always the big question, right? And you've seen, and now again, with changing commodity prices, coal's becoming more attractive in certain places. I don't know that that's like, you know, I don't know that that has the time horizon of the other fossil fuels.
In what way? It doesn't have the time horizon.
Because it's unlikely that coal will continue to be viable over the next decade in the way that oil and gas will likely continue to be viable.
You mean viable just from an economic standpoint?
Yeah, exactly.
Price point, yeah. Oil and gas, especially natural gas, will likely be a part of the transition to fully renewable in the coming decades, but they'll be a part of that for the coming decades. Coal might be on its last gasp just from natural economic forces in the coming years, not decades.
Yeah, at least in places like the US, right? I mean, I think coal is still likely to play a big role in, say, India.
Gotcha. Now, so you also referenced that about 15 years ago, there was the clean energy boom bust cycle where, you know, a number of early stage investors, VCs and the whatnot, kind of got burned by over-investing in clean energy back in that cycle. Have investors learned the correct lessons from that last clean energy investment cycle?
So this drives me absolutely crazy. Like the way in which so many investors are still reluctant to invest in clean energy and related technology because of what happened 15 years ago is amazing. And you can see if you just look at the statistics, there's still sort of a lag in terms of how much clean energy investment we're seeing. And some of that is justified in terms of how we think about venture and clean energy, right? There are structural reasons why investing in a new source of power is different from investing in a new type of social software, right? And so, and those are some of the lessons we learned, that you can't finance, you know, a new power generator the same way you finance Facebook, because that's just not how it works. However, you know, the idea that like the only thing you can invest in, for example, is batteries is obviously like, or the fact, or just discussing the price of solar panels is ridiculous, right? There's huge amounts of different technologies and different innovations, including software, including like ag tech, that need investment as part of the clean energy transition, and many of whom are going to be profitable. And so suggesting that like, because of something that happened, and it's not like, you know, people didn't stop investing in real estate because of the subprime mortgage crisis. You know, in fact, we're seeing, you know, another block in real estate right now, precisely because people went back into real estate and made a bunch of money. So, you know, I think that frankly, there's a lot of residual prejudice there, particularly by longtime investors who are, for example, very familiar with oil and gas investing, but not necessarily as familiar with, you know, cleaner energy and other types of investment opportunities.
Right, because oil and gas essentially require their commodities, and so you require them to burn, and so there's a continued kind of payment source. You're talking about renewables. That's you're talking about initial upfront infrastructure investments, and so that's a different type of investment. But the cash flows are work differently in the long term than traditional oil and gas.
Yeah, so you have to think about them very differently, right? But that doesn't mean that they're bad investments per se. It just means that you have to have the right models and the right understanding in place to know what you're doing.
And the right type of capital. You have to have capital that is long-term and large sources of infrastructure type capital sources, which is exactly what these institutional investors are providing.
Yeah, exactly. But and that's where a lot of the venture capital investors got tripped up, right? Sort of in the clean tech boom. And so that lesson is an important lesson, right? But my point as well is it doesn't mean that there aren't other venture opportunities out there, right? So that, and that could be, you know, like, I don't know, like carbon offset technology, right? To measure your carbon footprint. There are other investment opportunities out there. It's not just a bunch of solar panels and a bunch of like batteries or wind farms.
I think that's a good place to end it for this podcast. Thank you so much, and good to be back with you, Imogen Rose Smith.
Good to be back with you as well, Brian. Thank you.
And that's going to do it for this week's Impact Briefing. You can hear more about all of these stories at impactalpha.com. Thanks again to Imogen Rose Smith and our producer extraordinaire, Isaac Silk. Ready to try Impact Alpha? Sign up for Impact Alpha Open, completely free, directly at impactalpha.com. Want to go deeper? Grab a subscription and get full access to Impact Alpha, including the award-winning Morning Brief and our popular Agents of Impact calls. Just go to impactalpha.com/subscribe and choose an annual subscription. I'm Brian Walsh. Be sure to check back for next week's briefing. Until next time, take good care.